Hello and welcome to the first episode of Truth News Radio Australia for 2009. It's Tuesday, the 9th of March, and I'm Herewood Fenton, and I'll be here with you for the next hour or so to discuss matters of great importance. We've had a bit of a break from broadcasting this show for a few months, but we're planning to get right back into it. And we're going to bring you each week a unique show with some really important interviews. So I hope you stay with us, and I hope you really enjoy what we have to deliver you and take what we've said and apply it in your own life. Now tonight, we're going to be first of all talking to John Bursell from the Australian Truth Action Group, and he's going to be telling us a whole lot about what's planned for this year. After that, we're going to be joining with Josh Jackson, and we're going to catch up on a whole swag of stuff. And we may even get a chance to chat with Maria Polydor, who's just back from the United States and has spent time with We Are Change New York doing some really interesting stuff. So, without further ado, let's move ahead with the show.
G'day, Herewood. How are you doing?
Look, I'm, you know, incredibly well. I'm just, like, so busy these days. I'm doing so many different things. And but it seems to be working, like everything is just hanging together on some kind of magical system. Yeah,
it seems that way. We think that we've sort of reached an impasse with some of the things we're attempting to achieve. You know, most notably 9/11 Truth, and just when we see things fading away in one area, another area leaps ahead and bolsters our confidence that we're making change.
Yeah, it certainly does. It just it sort of motivates you, I think. You know, when you're involved in something that that is kind of changing the world, which I hadn't really been, I guess, up until I got involved in doing this, it's different. Like you've got the ordinary world, the working day, the working things that you have to do, but then you've got this, you know, this other thing that you have to do, and you know you've got to keep doing it. And it's sort of far more real than the other things. Although, I mean, obviously, you know, you've got a family and you've got, you know, really important things going on in your personal life too. But it's just that, you know, there's just this other level at the moment. I think a lot of people are feeling it. I don't know.
I think there is for sure. We just see so many changes in the world, and you can't help but think that we've got a subtle, you know, effect on things that are happening at a world level at the moment with what's happening with 9/11. With the truth that's coming out, and also with the financial crisis and other things that are breaking through, you know, things about, you know, vaccinations or about other you know, issues that we've heard about in the past. But it's all starting to come together now, where people are starting to realise that, you know, really black is white and white is black, you know. That's really taking us to some new places, I think, as individuals and as a community. And but obviously, I know you're in agreement with me that 9/11 is the strongest case, basically because we've got so much evidence. And
well, it's interesting.
We've also got such strong people now behind us and organisations as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, people often say that 9/11 kind of doesn't matter. Okay, you get a lot of different things. You get people who agree with you that 9/11 needs to be investigated or that it was a totally inside job, but they just think, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. Everyone already knows. And so a lot of people kind of get lost or distracted from this problem of thinking that there's no point in talking about it anymore. Whereas I've kind of, like, even though there's a whole lot of other things that I'm very interested in and sort of want to get more involved in, I still think that you can't have this attitude of trailing away or trailing off pursuing this issue. Because if you trail off, then nothing will be done, you know. Like, I mean, I know you understand, but I think sometimes people have this thought that, well, you know, everyone already knows that 9/11 is an inside job, so let's move on to something else.
They don't have the fortitude or the perseverance. I mean, maybe it's got something to do with the fact that I used to do marathon canoeing races when I was younger, or that I've been interested in pursuits that take a lot of effort to achieve. I mean, I know that you're a musician, and you probably understand the amount of practice required to achieve something musically that sounds good to someone else.
Yeah, I certainly try, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, perseverance in today's very soundbite, sort of environment that's, people want things very quick and they're looking for quick, instant pleasure. They're looking for, even with 9/11 Truth, people, I mean, I sort of thought that it would be out in a year after I initially came to the realisation of what was going on. But now I've come to realise that it's a very, very long struggle and a very difficult struggle.
Yeah.
But there's so much encouraging evidence that we've passed the first few stages now. We're at the stage now where we're lobbying. We have all the evidence. We have the scientific research that's required to make a case to politicians and make a case to academia. And if we do that, we will win. But we have to be persistent enough to make that case. And just as we see some of the activist groups sort of starting to diminish a little bit, because people sort of they're realising, yeah, that the public do know, then maybe we need not to be so worried about. Worried about like getting the information out to everyone, but maybe we need to be more targeted and concentrate on people that can make a difference within the bureaucracy. Because I think we really have achieved throughout the world now that anyone that's interested in finding out alternate truths about events and anyone that's got the intelligence to figure out there was something up with 9/11 at the beginning, which I did, and I think a lot of 9/11 truth activists had an inkling there was something strange.
Yeah.
I think most of those people have probably been got to by now with enough information to let them move forward to the point where they understand that it was an inside job. But we have to continue to try to present this information to the people that can actually make change in the universities and in the political circles. And
I think
the
it's
way
also
that we do that is by, putting on events or by lobbying directly or by doing what Evelyn or Traveller EV's done in New Zealand with just consistently, knocking away on doors and eventually have a breakthrough. Like we have the, Janet Fitzsimmons signing up to the political leaders for 9/11 Truth just a few days ago.
Yeah.
And that's, people, I haven't seen one comment on the net yet about the work that Evelyn's done, but I know the work that she's done because I've seen the emails and I've seen the subtle approach that's taken her years.
I think
get
it's
that
also
achievement.
Like what you're saying there is very important. It's like this unique thing about this group known as the 9/11 Truth Movement is that they've established a very high quality, a very high standard of information, and I really think that's key. Is that and she Evelyn who drew the attention of Janet Fitzsimmons, who's the co-leader of the New Zealand Greens, to the case for reinvestigating 9/11, pointed out in her letter which she published today on the 9/11 Oz website that there's this really important thing about presenting it calmly, carefully, and politely, and being persistent. And I think that's what the people who have moved ahead with this movement have done. I mean, there are this core group of people who've just been really, they've set a really good standard for quality of information. And that's the difference, you see, between just, being concerned and getting upset and maybe, talking to people and wanting to be an activist and actually moving this forward. It seems to me that the 9/11 information is going to make a difference in a way that, say, well, we had all this information about previous events that didn't quite, never made it through the media filters about the JFK assassination or, false flag terrorism, the attack on the Liberty, Vietnam War, many different things that have happened over my lifetime. Now, I think we've now got a focus on something that's very important, and we just have to keep focused on it. Like we just have to keep bringing back the conversation points to these key points. And like one of the things that I often try to emphasize is that the reason why we often talk about the collapse of the World Trade Center and things like the melting point of steel is not because that is the most important piece of evidence. Are you with me on that page? Like, I think that is not the most important thing. It's just that it's the one thing that we can prove most forensically.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you look at the information about 9/11 and the who the perpetrators are, the description, you know, that they put forward about what they wanted to create, you know, pro bono, who benefits, all those different aspects of the crime that really puts it all together for people that are seriously interested in it. That's great, but the thing is that all that is surrounded with conjecture, and it has to be put together as a puzzle, which can only really be done successfully in a courtroom. But what we have with the controlled demolition of the towers, and especially Building 7, is we have irrefutable direct evidence that proves there's added energy, and that's the end game. We're done.
Yeah, you can prove with scientific method that this does not match with what the official explanation is. No, it doesn't. It doesn't prove who did it.
Vastly different, in fact, to such a degree that it can't be. It's not semantics, you know. Like it's obvious that once someone looks into the information about the collapse of the towers, that physical laws are broken. There's direct evidence of explosives. There's explosive residue and byproducts and signatures, chemical signatures. And then we also have the physical, you know, collapse of the buildings, which is obviously a demolition when it's viewed with a clear mind, that is supported by other sort of demolitions that you can see. So, yeah, really, that's the reason we focus on that, is because it's the best proof that there was something other than we were told happened on 9/11. And that's really all we've got to achieve. And the next part is really up to, you know, a judge and a jury to decide.
Yeah, the next part becomes the full investigation, where all of the potential witnesses have to be, you know, subpoenaed. There has to be full disclosure from government officials, you know, under subpoena, you know, all of that has to happen. But the steps to getting there are this forensic evidence. And that is a lead in to basically what I really want to talk about with you, is the conference that we've organized and that you've really spearheaded for November of 2009, which is really going to focus on that best evidence, that forensic evidence, that irrefutable physical evidence. We've got Richard Gage, the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, the founding member of that. We've got Stephen Jones, the, you know, probably the most important single scientist to join the 9/11 Truth movement. We've also got very important people who've been part of the movement from the beginning, organizing and you know, keeping it focused and credible.
Exactly. And I mean, having Janice Matthews, obviously we're a little short on females in the movement, but she's a mother of five and she's a farmer, but she's also a teacher, and you know, she's an English teacher, and she's someone that, you know, doesn't waste her time with things of little importance. But she's, you know, she's taken 911truth.org through the hard years and maintained credibility. And that's the same thing that we see Alan, or also known as Reprehensor, at 9/11 Blogger doing. These people that have just kept the guard up, kept moving forward, but have been careful with what they've said and what they've done, they're the people that have underpinned this movement and have allowed us to get where we've got. You know, it's not the people that are out there that are, you know, spinning tails or, you know, frothing in the mouth around the place that are making the real change. Any person that studies politics will know that conservative change, slow moving change, is the change that really lasts and will make a real difference. You know, the idea that we were going to break open with a massive news story about 9/11 in the mainstream media was something that I sort of believed in at one stage, but I've now realised that that's not how it's going to happen. It's going to happen by osmosis or diffusion, or like a real gradual process. And you'll just see more and more people clocking up in these different organisations. What have we got now? We've got Politicians for 9/11 Truth. We've got, just recently, we've got Medical Professionals for 9/11 Truth. We've got Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, which is another very important aspect. We've got the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. We've got Pilots for 9/11 Truth. We've got Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. We really have every aspect now of society that is any way, has any speciality or a concern in social justice and in engineering or architecture really involved. And, of course, underpinning all of that, we have the Scholars for Truth and Justice, which is a split group from the original group, which is a much more focused and quality group now that has the Journal of 9/11 Study. So we have a library now of peer-reviewed articles, three of them that have now been published in actual journals. You know, it's amazing what we've put together. And sometimes I think people just don't really have any understanding about the effort that some of these people have put into things. Even some of the things that we see on Richard Gage's presentation, which we will get to see in November.
Okay.
The animations, you know, the
huge numbers of hours of work
under microscopes and spectrometers and doing all this stuff that has to be all logged and clearly, you know, the dust samples that have to be, you know, that have to follow this certain regulation so that they're scientifically usable in court and all this.
I mean, people have compared what these guys are doing to, you know, Galileo.
Absolutely, I think so.
You know, quite rightly, because the way I see it is they are reasserting something that's core to Western civilization, which is a respect for science, you know, a scientific approach, a respect for empirical knowledge, rational thought, over against, and what they're working against is this ideological, almost supernatural kind of focus that's now driving everything. You know, fear being the driving force and the necessity to believe in things without questioning them. You know, they are, and you know, there's very strong parallels there with medieval church.
Absolutely, I think it's really interesting that you bring that up, because that's something I think about a lot. And you know, like the idea that it's important, truth is important in its own right, but when we consider the fact of how important 9/11 was, and people, you know, seem to forget this, but then it was and Barack Obama's already invoked it numerous times for policy that he's implementing today, you know, and then people keep saying, oh, well, you know, it happened then, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, the reason that when I talk to someone, you know, I was talking to a doctor where I'm staying at the moment, we were having a game of tennis, and I got into a conversation with this doctor at Wollongong Hospital. And, you know, and you see their fear and you see, but, you know, the thing is that we've got, if we're careful, we can quickly build credibility with these people by working around the edges of these issues and then move them, you know, to the next step, which is really questioning the events of 9/11. Now, when you see the fear and you see the confusion and the defensive stance of these people, even when they're listening to you and they're not disregarding you, or they're not, you know, sort of thinking that you're crazy, but they're still feeling this fear and this real inner turmoil. Like, it's difficult to talk to these people about this, you know. I still find it difficult today. Now, why do I find it difficult? Because I was traumatized by those events. We all were traumatized by those events. We're psychologically raped by those events.
And it's hard to talk about it freely.
Can't stand.
It becomes hard to have a balanced discussion about it, because there's been so much. We all know there's been so much, you know, even, you know, in the wake of it, you know, there's been so much death and destruction that's been brought on in the wake of those events too, that there's a lot invested now in the official story. So anyway, just maybe to just let's just bring let's it back to this year
to
and
the,
what's
event,
what's actually
yeah.
really happening this year. Yeah. I mean, there's quite a few things we need to just basically recap for the audience. And I mean, I'd like to just maybe recap where we're at now in Australia. And I know we've got a for instance a lecture by David Leifer coming up in June.
Yes,
you know,
right.
we've got the head of the Greens in New Zealand coming on board. Hopefully that's going to help some people here make some decisions, if we can communicate to them and make them aware of it.
I've learned a lesson from, I've really blown my local level influence with the Greens now, because I became very frustrated at a meeting, which is a lesson for everyone not to become frustrated. But I still have the ear of a couple of Green politicians directly. And there are others that have the ear of politicians directly in Australia as well.
Okay.
So, you know, that it is possible. And it's we're hopeful that there could be movement there. But obviously, you can't really talk about it, because politics is a lot about trust as well. Like, Evelyn had been, like, talking to me in private about, you know, advice about talking to Jeanette in New Zealand, you know. But she was extremely quiet about the fact, you know, that Jeanette was, you know, thinking these thoughts, because if these people are got at before they make statements, you know, they can be easily swayed around. We have to be very careful, you know. So sometimes we waste energy and we can actually make our job much harder. Now, I've sort of done that with my local Greens group, because after spending 2 years of helping them and doing other things and presenting all the evidence calmly, I had people frothing in the mouth in meetings when I was trying to pass a motion as simple as supporting the American Greens in their quest for a new investigation, saying that there's absolutely no evidence backing our case, and that I'm a nut. Now, when people say that, it's very difficult not to get angry. I found it too difficult, so I did get angry. Now, that's a lesson that we probably should learn, and from seeing what Evelyn's done in New Zealand, it's given me renewed strength to think that I have to remain patient. We can make breakthroughs, and it's not going to be with a consensus with public. You know, you're not going to get motions up in public meetings of the general population about this issue.
It's definitely a numbers game. I mean, it's definitely a leadership game.
We have to get leaders. People need to have leaders to follow on these sorts of issues, and that's something that Jeanette's offered now. She's offered leadership. She's stepped up and she's put her head in the chopping block. And that will encourage others to come forward. And human nature, it's easy to get a consensus, to hate something that the media has been, spooking about for years in a public meeting. Yes. Is it easy to get something like 9/11, a motion about 9/11 up in a public meeting? No, it's extremely difficult because it's most people are very, very scared of it. Some people even fear that they could be, could face retribution by questioning such an event.
Yeah.
So these sorts of things are very, very difficult to deal with. And Ken Jenkins on the Sunday of the events in November, we're going to have a 9/11 Truth in Action, We Are Change event on the Sunday. And Ken's just written a new article that I'll send to you, and hopefully we'll put it up at 9/11 Oz. Extremely interesting article about dealing with these psychological barriers. And, there has to be a subtlety, but a very narrow focus with 9/11 Truth, and that's what we're aiming at with this hard evidence. Even though we're being very audacious with, the event we're calling the event, the hard evidence was 9/11 was an inside job, that is directly factually correct. There's no doubt with anyone that's looking into it that that's true. Now, that's really, and we're trying to antagonise the press with that. So in one way, we can put on a public event that really is trying to get interest from the press and really trying to challenge people to the question asked. That's one method. Another method is we're subtly talking and, quietly on the phone and by email to people within, spheres of influence, caressing them along this journey,
The
other thing we've got is the public thing where we're just disseminating information to the general population, hoping that every 100 or so people we wake up, there could be another activist there that will do the same things we're doing. So, it's working on all these different levels, but we have to...
Can you give us a little bit of info about the upcoming lecture by David Leifer, another really important Australian who's... stepped up and really, really stuck his neck out. David Leifer,
and he's not getting any direct heat from the university either. And that's one thing. Australia seems to be less interested than most of the world in the 9/11 issue. Now, why that exactly is, whether it's because we're wealthier or happier or the mainstream media is worse, which is probably all three are true.
I think they've learnt how to ignore very effectively, and
it seems that way,
that is actually the most powerful tool for censorship, is to just ignore.
David, you would have thought that David, when he did that first lecture we did last year at the university there, we would have thought that there would have been some people there challenging his views on the collapse of the towers. Now, what David's work has been around predominantly, it's really been two facets. It's been looking at World Trade Center 1, the North Tower, and how it's collapsed, and focusing on specifically, the architecture of it and the way that it's collapsed and the fact, the improbability of it, comparing all the things that we know about buildings and how they operate. He's been having a sort of really use that improbability argument to say that so many things are so improbable that it's impossible that it can happen. So that was one of the arguments. The other argument was he was concentrating on the leaning of that tower, the rotation around the fulcrum as it fell away, the 20-odd degrees that the South Tower had moved before it fell away. So he's been looking at those two things. He also was dabbling in looking at the amount of energy required to pulverize the concrete. So he's trying to specialise in some areas that other people aren't necessarily looking at directly. And I think you'll see a lot of these scholars now are trying to do that. They're trying to look at a niche area that someone hasn't really investigated. And all they're really doing is they're just building this case, you know, more and more and more that supports where we're coming from. So when we get people like NIST or Popular Mechanics or some other joker that really does not interested in the truth, really just interested in putting forward the official story, questions one element, then we can contest that directly, but then we can provide other evidence that corroborates what we're saying. And that's what these guys are doing. They're building these, you know, they're building this castle made on these rock solid foundations of truth, you know, regarding the collapse of these buildings. You know, every single element now is being looked at, down to the 5/8 bolts that hold the truss and how much load they can take, and you know, and how that means that consequently they would have broken before, you know, the wall trusses were pulled in with the latest global collapse theory. Like, they're just breaking
it's all critical, vital information.
Tiny little things, like NIST should. Like, we've got, I think, in a year or so's time, someone will be able to put together a report about the collapse of the buildings, even though they have had zero funding and they've had you know, really zero access to the materials. We'll have something that can explain the collapse of the buildings nearly exactly. And that's purely by these fellows taking great interest in this and seeing the importance of it.
Dr. Leifer is going to be giving a lecture in June. Do you actually have a date and a time and a place for that?
There is a date and a time and a place and an email I've got somewhere, but
I'm afraid I don't have it on my fingertips either. So
he was in no hurry to announce it yet. He wanted to wait until it was a little bit closer to the event.
Well, we'll keep this radio show updated with that information. As soon as it's firm, we'll broadcast that.
In the evening and so on. I think it's on a Thursday.
Okay.
It's in the main lecture hall there for a couple of hours, so, you know, he'll have plenty of time, excuse me, to really lay out the case. He did give me a brief synopsis about what it was about, but I think it's concentrating on World Trade Center 1.
Yeah.
So he's really doing a detailed explanation of that collapse. And by this way, too, he's not putting forward any ideas of who or what might have caused the collapse exactly. He's just contesting the official story. So,
but I think this event is an excellent opportunity. It's an excellent opportunity for anyone who wants to bring someone along who's maybe on the fence or who knows very little about it, skeptical. Mm. It's you know, it's a perfect opportunity to actually introduce someone to this information. So anyone who's listening tonight, you know, really think about contacting anyone you know, especially if they are engineers or architects or work in any kind of discipline, you know, field related to that. You know, this is going to be something that they can engage with, and they can ask questions from a professional, which we don't often get a chance to do.
No.
So,
and we'll probably, I plan when I get back from this last trip, I'm away at the moment in Canberra, but I plan running up to that event, hopefully to get some people out and about around Sydney Uni and get this information out to some of the students indirectly, and let's see if we can, you know, get a decent turn up, and then we can springboard that.
Because, like, we've all had the experience of trying to explain some of this physics stuff to random people and to, you know, friends. And if you're not trained in physical sciences, I mean, I'm not, right? It gets really hard to explain it in detail, especially, you know, to explain why a free fall collapse can't occur without an excess of energy. I mean, you have to be able to explain it with a confidence that you don't necessarily have if you haven't got the training. And because I've seen a lot of people go through this when they've been trying to explain it, and they get a little bit tongue-tied. Mm. And sometimes people get frustrated and they just sort of want the other person to just see it and recognize it, you know. But you do have to present it step by step. You know, you've got to take the person by the hand and lead them through step by step. Otherwise, you could be seen as a crank, yeah? Because there are plenty of principles that
activists have learned to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, the explanations, say, for instance, of, you know, the top section of the building being with withdrawn from the building and dropped in the air, and how that, you know, their collapse was very close to that. But still, the amount of mass involved, like, people can come up with questions rather rapidly, and that's why it's very interesting that we've seen some of the scholars, especially people like Frank Legg, who will be on the panel that evening. We've seen lectures from Frank numerous times. He's very good at taking, maybe it's because he's a farmer.
So Frank Legg will be on the panel in the November conference.
The panel's going to have some extremely interesting people there.
Yeah.
Now, I'll briefly just go through. He'll be on the panel.
So this is for the November conference.
Yeah, for the Saturday event. Yeah, sure. The hard evidence, 9/11 was the inside job. We'll have Dr. David Leifer, who's an architect and incorporated engineer. Then we'll have Dr. Frank Legg, who's a chemist, who's been doing a lot of work directly with Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, looking at the actual dust and other things and analysing the collapses and looking for simple ways to explain things to people. We've got Paul Mason, who's a structural engineer who actually works inspecting buildings. Now, we have numerous structural engineers now in Australia. If you go to the architects and engineers list and take the time to have a look, you'll see we've got about three structural engineers now that are signatures to the...
That's really important, isn't it? Structural engineers
they're the people
important.
That really have the greatest input, I think.
Yeah.
Then we'll have James O'Neill, who's a barrister, who we know he's also a convener of the Greens. Now, I know you myself and others have things that we can test with the Greens, but we still have to agree, and I think I've been proven right again that even though the Greens might be following some path that we mightn't agree with, they're still the most open party at the moment in Australia and in New Zealand and in most places in the world.
They've got the most potential, I think, for being a wedge.
It's good to have him along, and it bolsters because he's respected within the Greens, and he hasn't got angry like I have, and he actually hasn't tried to pass motions with his local group. He was smarter than that. He's been giving lectures to professionals and you know, building his dossier of supporters along the way, and he'll pick the time and the place when he chooses to bring forward a motion to his group. He'll do that when he knows he has the numbers. You know, and this is the sort of thing that politicians do. You know, good politicians play those sorts of games because that's how you win. You know, people like myself that have no real idea and just want to see the truth come out aren't necessarily so good at that, you know. But James is doing an excellent job because he's, you know, he's talking to other barristers, he's talking to engineers, he's talking to all sorts of people all around his local area, and he's building up, you know, support, you know, before he starts trying to take it to a political level, because he realises that to get a consensus at a public meeting about this issue is impossible. You know, he's a very smart man, obviously. Anyway, and then we also have Luke Radowski on that panel. Now, the reason I put Luke Radowski on that panel, even though he's an
Luke Radowski is the founder of We Are Change.
That's right. The person that we see confronts people, you know, like David Rockefeller and confronts people like Brzezinski and all these other people that, you know, are criminals and are people that are pulling strings that are causing events like 9/11. You know, he's a hero of mine. He's a man that has no fear. He just wants justice, and he'll, you know, risk it all for the cause. And he's directly linked and cares directly for many of the first responders and victims of 9/11. He's very involved at that level, and he knows many, many firemen and other people that were involved in the day, and so consequently he's like an eyewitness. He really represents a lot of the first responders, so that's great to have him there. And now, as you know, recently, we haven't really announced it officially yet, it's most likely William Rodriguez will be coming, and I will be placing him on that panel as well, as an eyewitness to the events. Now, you know, we can't get a better lineup than this. You know, if people don't attend this event, and I threw this out to my local Greens group, I said, "Come along, I'll give you a ticket to this event for free." I've only got two people that are interested in coming. So, you know, like it doesn't really matter sometimes how much effort we go to put up these lineups. We still have to get these people there. Now, that's the challenge, is to get people there. Now, how we do that, I don't know, but we know that we'll have, you know, at least 200 or so people that will come along from what we've seen in recent times that are interested, and there will be in the crowd, which we found out recently. We found out on Alex Jones' show that there was a couple of filmmakers that came along to the last conference that we weren't aware of.
Indeed.
And there was engineers and people that we weren't aware of as well. So there are people that will turn up, you know, to these events that we won't really be aware of, but to expect that we can force or challenge our friends or our associates, our direct associates in the workplace, and they're going to come, it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, I think we should really not be too concerned about any individual, any one person who comes or doesn't come.
Just got to keep throwing it out there.
Yeah,
you've got to
meet new people, contact new people, expand your sphere of contacts. And, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's building up. It's interesting. I mean, it's going to reach a point there where it has to, I think, ignite some interest from the media. I mean, we've got to get some kind of attention.
Richard Gage has got mainstream media everywhere he's been.
Okay.
William Rodriguez has got mainstream media everywhere he's been. Like, I mean, in the country, not every city, but within a country that he's gone to, he's had mainstream media. So has Stephen Jones and so has Richard Gage. And, you know, and Luke Radowski's made media everywhere he's gone.
I think it's highly likely, John, that the ABC will finally, you know, bite the bit and do something on this topic.
Well, we'll have a case for, you know, failing in their fiduciary duty to the Australian public if they don't.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about...
They'll have to put up with weeks and months of protest in front of their offices if they don't report it.
I'm thinking about television programs like Late Line, you know, Kerry O'Brien, is it? I mean, it's the sort of thing that should, you know, go on Late Line or something like that as a full news feature story with a background piece and an interview, you know. I mean, we know that it won't be terribly friendly, you know. We know that they'll probably have some people on there to debunk and make it quite aggressive. But at least I do think that if they do need to actually treat this as a news story. But I think we've got the opportunity to make that happen by just making it irresistible, you know. Irresistible from the point of their own media publicity, you know.
And the great thing about this is that all these people are coming to this country for free, you know, except for the airfares and for, you know, the accommodation costs, you know, the bare essentials. But none of these people are charging speaking fees. And they're the best people in the world, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's... It's just, there's so much good energy surrounding these people, you know. Like, they're just excellent, excellent people, and they're people that are really, really helping the world be sustainable in, you know, in the sense that we know it, in a free and just sense. And you know, to be ignored, it'd be a travesty if they were completely ignored. But if it happens, if they do ignore us, then it just goes to prove we have to fight even harder, you know. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't end with any particular event or a particular conference, but really we're presenting absolutely the best lineup that we can present. And if we don't get pressed, then it's just an indictment on Australia. It makes Australia the most censored, heavily censored media in the world, worse than anywhere in the old Russian Republic. There's no doubt.
Yeah, and I actually think that the end result is going to be, if there is an end result, that alternative media, like what we're doing tonight, will eventually just take over from the defunct, you know, corrupt, decrepit, you know, media structure that we've got now, because people will turn away from it.
Don't forget, lazy and fearful.
Right, yeah, yes.
Two other words I think of.
Lazy and fearful, yeah, definitely lazy, yeah. And, you know, unless... The only thing that they can do to prevent that would be to try and shut down the internet or restrict the internet, because people are continually turning to the internet and finding it more interesting, finding a better choice, just a wider variety of views and issues. And, you know, the alternative media that's available could end up just basically silently just replacing what we've thought of as the media. And some of these large organizations could just end up, you know, disappearing.
The only problem we have with the internet, which is being resolved over time as things do, is credibility. And what we see is we see sites now that, you know, like one that I like to go to quite regularly, and I think is very quite accurate, is like globalresearch.ca.
Okay.
Open Edition News. You know, there's some of these news sources now that we're starting to trust because we've seen evidence over time that they're providing the best news. Other news sources, that's, you know, like InfoWars, say, for instance, can be a little loose.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there are other places that people go for news that, you know, we know with 9/11 Blogger, even though there's been mistakes made there, they're always retracted and, you know, they've got an attitude to resolve, you know, issues of credibility. And as we move on as a movement, we've really done a lot to lift the standards of media within the internet, because we're very insistent and persistent activists as far as getting it right. And people that don't put up the right information for the hardcore 9/11 truth activists and other truth activists don't get supported. And that's really done us a great service by being critical.
That's where it comes back to that, you know, holding up the flame of, you know, those core things about truth and reason and, you know,
scientific method,
rationale,
that sort of stuff.
And it doesn't imply, now I have to emphasize, when I say that, I don't imply that anyone who has a supernatural belief or a spiritual belief is somehow a lesser person. I certainly don't mean that. And, you know, it's not about that. It's not about enforcing some kind of dogma of materialistic atheism. Not at all. I also think
more than 50% of our speakers are religious.
We have a balance. We've got a true diversity of people from different perspectives, and that is also the strength of it. You know, and it shows, I think, that there is an underlying truth and an underlying core of truth, which is there that we can all partake of. There doesn't need to be. I think that a lot of the conflicts and divisions that you see popping up between people, for example, you know, that just to give an example, the film Zeitgeist, which has been very popular on the internet, has alienated a lot of people who are very, you know, religious, because it took a particular attitude towards Christianity and religion. Now, that type of thing does, you know, it certainly stirs the pot and creates, you know, interest. But that direction isn't the direction where the 9/11 truth movement's going.
No.
And you know, and it's very important to see that clearly, you know. And you know, I'm not saying I want to have a go at Peter Joseph's and Zeitgeist, you know. It's okay. It's got some good information, but where the cutting edge is not in asserting any kind of utopian dogma or any kind of dogma about the truth, right? It's about sort of being. I mean, you can be a Christian, and you can be a 9/11 truther, and you can be a scientist, and none of those things are mutually exclusive. You can also be a non-Christian. You can be an agnostic. You can be an atheist. If as long as you basically respect science, it's okay. I mean, some people, you know, who have like a very profound religious view, are able to basically say, well, you know, that's the spiritual sphere of life. But when I get into the laboratory, it's about science. And, you know, it's like, you know,
in the physical world.
Yeah, in the physical world.
You made some statement about this recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Some blog I was reading somewhere that you were talking about the physical world. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the reality that everyone sees. You know, not the reality for an individual, but the common reality, the physical world, the actual things that happen and make things happen on the large scale, you know. Now, obviously, if you believe in a God or you believe in miracles or whatever, that's great, but that's God making those miracles or doing those things, and that's in another, like another dimension or however you want to see it, but it's not in the physical world. And no one, you know, no one has views that you know, that Dick Cheney and George Bush could bring those towers down with a miracle.
Yeah,
you know,
like, yeah, yeah,
you know, that's,
exactly.
Then that's what you're saying. They're not mutually exclusive. They're different things, completely different things.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, actually. Yeah, yeah.
But, and, you know, it's you know, it's hard for me. I'm not a religious person, but do I believe that there's some energy out there maybe, or some other dimension? Who knows? But, you know, I'm open-minded to it. But I don't know. It's funny, like, actually becoming a truth activist, and within 9/11, I've actually become more accepting of others.
That's a great
because
statement.
I see that people can have the common truth in their hearts and in their minds, and they can have all sorts of views on other things.
Beautiful. Excellent summation. I think we probably need to move on with the show. It's really been excellent talking to you, John. And you're welcome to hang around. We're going to interview. We're going to get Josh on the show shortly.
Big Josh.
And Big Josh. And we're going to try for a hookup with Maria Polydor, who's just returned from New York.
Excellent.
So we'll just pause there for a break. By the way, you're listening to Bizet's Je Crois Entendre Encore from the Pearlfishers, sung in Yiddish by an unknown singer. If anyone knows who this is, please email me. Okay, we are back with Truth News Radio Australia, and I am Herewood Fenton, and I have with me tonight your favourite co-host, Josh Jackson. Welcome back, G'day. Josh.
G'day, folks. How are you going? Herewood, how are you?
How are we going, indeed? Well, look, it's been a bit of a hiatus for Truth News Radio, hasn't it? But, you know, I've been getting a bit of feedback from a few people I've met recently that I had no idea, you know, that they even existed and they were listening to this show. What do you think of that? I mean, it's quite good, isn't it? I mean, it even if it's just a couple of people that you didn't know about who are listening, it's actually quite inspiring.
Oh, absolutely. When you get feedback saying, hey, I miss your show, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
Where have you been? And, you know, it's just been a rough beginning of the year, trying to get back on track, a lot of projects on. And but Truth News is we're going to go for a regular from now on, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm going to try and keep a regular weekly, and I'm going to be basically bringing Josh on via Skype and other, you know, guests on via Skype. Hopefully one day we'll get a studio, but I think we'll just continue with this for a while. It's a little bit easier, actually, for me to manage it, Skyping people in rather than having a whole lot of people in my, you know, my living quarters.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you think we're broadcasting from a studio, no, it's much more, you know, it's a little bit more tricky than that. Yeah.
But it is, you have got some good equipment, you know, it's all getting there. Now, so folks, please write in if you have any sort of, you know, feedback on the quality of sound with this new setup with Skype and stuff. We'd love to hear your feedback. As always, that's truthnews.com.au. So what are we going to mention? I think one thing that we haven't really gone head on into is the global economic crisis. Now, we haven't touched upon this because there was so much going on last year that we were watching this rolling in this train wreck. I mean, we've been, you know, privately talking about this for the last 2 years, but you know, all the events are coming true. All the you know, people say, oh, people on the news and the mainstream media keep on going on about how, oh, this, you know, we never saw it coming. How could it just came out of nowhere and all this garb.
Yeah. It's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's absurd. Alex Jones was talking about it for years. I mean, some of these people in the truth movement have been talking about it for years. It's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, some of these people that we know very well have been talking about this, and yet all these other people out there didn't know anything about it.
No. And you get these talking heads on the news. You know, I mean, people on CNN, Richard Gage, what's his
Richard
name?
Gage. Richard Gage. He's one of ours.
He's one of our. Anyway,
There's so many, and they blur. Yeah, no, sorry, continue.
Yeah, but someone like Koshy boys, Koshy.
Oh, it's absurd. I saw him the other day, Koshy, on telly, going, like, they really don't have a clue. And they fluff around the edges. And, you know, the real big thing that annoys me, Harold and John, about this is that they go back to blaming the poor on the global economic crisis. Now, how they do this is invoke... Oh, it's all because people couldn't pay their mortgages, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the poor are to blame for the entire trillion-dollar financial sector of the globe collapsing. You know?
Oh, you're so right. That so annoys me when I hear that. I get that on the BBC all the time. I listen to the BBC, you know, because I don't watch television. I listen to the BBC news radio, a few other European radio shows. They constantly have these little... you know, fluff pieces, these little kind of warm, fuzzy pieces where some smarty pants person comes on and basically blames people, you know, who wanted to get too much credit and overextended their mortgage for the situation. It's absurd. It wasn't because of that. These people were only doing what they had to do, what they were advised to do, what they really had no choice in. And I mean, look at someone who's had their money invested in super. They've had absolutely no choice in that. And the average super has lost about 25-30% now. So, I mean, you know, that's compulsory. That's mandatory by the government. But, you know, if you want to buy a house, I mean, everyone's been told that the most important thing to do is buy a house. We were told that over and over again. And the only way we could do that is by getting a loan. The only, you know, we could only do what was allowed to us by the system. And now the system's just It's theft. I mean, I call it as theft. It is. And Denis Kucinich, congressman from Ohio, said this in a recent speech, really excellent speech, which you can get on C-SPAN Junkies. He said it is the greatest theft of one class stealing from another in history. They've just basically stolen billions, trillions of dollars from the poorest people, the middle and the lower class of society, has been stripped and robbed of all their assets.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you bring up superannuation. Now, I think this is, This is quite an interesting one, Harold and John. Let's deconstruct the theft component of this. Now, if we have a look at superannuation, for instance, here we have a mechanism, whereas we are forced by the gun, because if you don't, then you go to prison or you get the police knocking your door if you don't follow the rules of these governments, to put our money into the super. Now, let's have a look at what happens to super. Now, there's two types of investors. You have the investor, which is typically a person that really studies companies, studies the CEOs of these companies, figures out the long-term strategies of these companies, and thinks, right, I'm going to invest in this company and put some money into them. And they're well thought out and you know, because it's their own money. Then you have the speculators. Now, they're a different type of investor. They basically just look at graphs, look at ups and downs. They wouldn't have a clue, and they don't care about who the CEOs are. They don't really care about any of that. They just see the line going up, and they go, right, yep, I've got a hunch with this one. We're going to go with this, you know. I mean, that's a little bit crude, but that's basically what it is. So yeah. What the problem here is with superannuation is that we have now forced trillions of dollars into the stock exchange onto the backs of these speculators throwing around money. Now, what happens when speculators, they sit there playing with the graphs of within minutes and seconds of these graphs going up and down. There's no long-term strategy. So you have these company CEOs, if they want to implement some long-term strategy that's going to bugger the graph for the next, you know, even half a year or 6 months until there's a long-term growth, then they're going to get fired. Now, you've got these CEOs who've studied 6 years to become CEO. They've gone through business school. They're not going to risk they're being thrown out onto the gutter and never get a job again on some long-term strategy when they could do short-term pump and dump type deals. They pump up and, you know, and then dump the stocks and do well for people's superannuation. And so you've got all these companies, banks, every one of them, doing these ridiculously bad business dealings to get a quick graph upturn that day or that hour or really short-term outlooks. Now, this is because the government have forced millions of people to put money towards speculators. I wouldn't have a clue what's happening with my money. And if I was putting my money in, I can tell you, and I can tell most of our listeners, would actually look at the companies they're investing at and figure out if it's good investment. They wouldn't just throw it on ups and downs of graphs, right?
So true. Josh, can I just ask quickly, are you familiar with a website and a animation called crisisofcredit.com?
Yeah, I have seen it. Is that the green-hued?
Yeah. It says a lot of what you've been saying there, and it explains it. I really recommend this strongly to anyone listening. It's 10 minutes long. It's just brilliant. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. It really, it packs a whole lot of punch. And this whole business about packaging up mortgages and selling mortgages as an instrument, as a package, there's a particular phrase they use, a something something package. Yeah. I'm not an expert.
Can I drop in on the, super John, discussion a little bit?
Indeed.
And just make a few comments, because I see what you're talking about there, Josh. But there are some super funds that, you know, are diversified enough, and like, say, for instance, my super fund, I was, because I knew a little bit more than the average person, I made sure I stayed in a 50-50 defined benefit. Now, that used to be how super was once upon a time, where you could have a portion of your super, or nearly all your super could be like 8 times your final salary in the company, would put money into an account to make sure that you would have your superannuation pension available. Now, things have changed, and it's really the confidence in this growth ideal, this ideal that things will continue to grow and we can cope with these interest and you know, obviously compound interest type scenarios by endless growth. Now, I think it really comes back to the fiducial, the duty of our knowledge of these people that are in the talking heads in the media, and that's why I think the media is probably the most responsible. Obviously, we know the people that are pulling the levers at the highest levels that we really have no control over, but the media, which we supposedly do have a control over, are the ones that have been saying that this is a never-ending ride to success. Even if things go down, they'll go up more later, and, you know, it's good to be in these aggressive, you know, super plans that are pulling, you know, between 12 and 20% which is completely unsustainable and unrealistic. Now, some of us chose to have, milder sort of like 10% growth options, say, for instance, and with half of it in defined benefit where the company guarantees your money, but you're not, speculators would say you're crazy because you should have all your money in the market because the market runs at these unreal amounts, forever, which is not true. I think it's really the media's fault for giving people the confidence to think that we can have endless growth and we can have a situation where people can continue to make these huge amounts of money in their super. That's just ridiculous. How do we ever buy that? But we seem to buy it as a community, didn't we?
Well, I also think, though, that the introduction of compulsory super, which was brought in after the last recession, 91, 92, was done as a way of inflating the bubble. And I think there were the reasons behind why they did that are not good. They're not genuine. It created a bubble when you had all this extra money flowing in because of compulsory super. Because, prior to that, super was, probably much less common than it is now. I mean, it's mandatory now,
So, well, people sacrificed paying their mortgage to put money into super because they saw that as a better investment. Now, that's doubling the debt, isn't it? You're speculating with your money, and then you're not paying off your mortgages or other expenses, your car, your credit card, because you want to put money into super because it's doing so well. No, it really was a sucker punch by the mega rich, I think, at the end game. That's really what it's all about.
The thing is, my main point was that you have, through coercion of government, the trillions of dollars slushing about a system that wasn't designed. I mean, the stock exchange wasn't designed to have trillions of dollars slushing around in speculatory manner. JP Morgan and stuff, they really enjoy it because they can make vast amounts of profits. But at the end of the day, you have now these CEOs of major banks and corporations and all sorts making very short-term decisions for their companies. So you get these companies making ridiculous and basically going broke in the long term to make short-term sort of pump-and-dump scenarios where they pump up their stocks to all hell, CEO leaves, sells the shares, and leaves the next CEO holding the bag and the shareholders holding the bag, but which in turn are the
the economy or the market lost its keel, like in a boat you've got all that gold or heavy metal down the bottom holding everything so that the boat won't topple. But when everything's just floating around in the boat, like the whole boat's full of water and it's all moving around, there's no ballast, there's no ribs to protect everything sloshing around in the place, then the whole thing can just flip over.
Yeah, because the stock exchange has got hardly any proper true investors anymore. You're sitting there. I mean, if I was the head of a company and I go to the meeting and say, right, I'm going to do, we're going to lose some money for the next 6 months, but I'm putting long-term infrastructure into place of good R&D, good this and that. My ass would be on the ground. I'd be out in the gutter because everyone would leave. The stock price would collapse overnight because all the speculators would run out the door and say, we're taking our money to the next big thing, which is going to make money in the next half an hour. But this is one little component, one micro component of this grand crisis. The other crisis we have is the monopolization of currency around the globe, meaning that the Federal Reserve System that's been franchised around the world, basically giving a monopoly to the means of exchange. So no one else can have the option. Basically, you're putting all our inflationary risk into one currency, which is in the hands of one guy at the head of the Federal Reserve, or the Australian Fed, or the American Fed, or whatever Fed you want to talk about, who aren't even voted in. Even if you think voting's some amazing thing that makes a difference, you don't even have the illusion that you can make a difference by voting for someone. These people just get signed.
Can you recommend any particular websites that listeners can go to? I mean, I've already recommended crisisofcredit.com and also moneyisdebt.net, which is an excellent film made by a Canadian, which is more general you know, it's general theoretical. But can you recommend anything that's up to date that can help people figure out what's going on?
Oh, geez. What I will do is I'll collate a couple of links because I don't have anything on me right now, but I can collate a few links that we can stick into the show notes.
Yeah, because it's such a minefield and it's such a confusing thing for me to understand as well. You know, and recently I had the opportunity to screen a film, this Money is Debt film, for some people here in Annandale in Sydney. And, you know, I think a lot of people found that pretty interesting because this particular film just explains the nature of the creation of money in our society, which is not widely known. And, you know, the concept of this debt bubble, which has been building and building and building, and historically it has its roots in decisions that were made generations ago, you know, really 70 years ago, this whole system was put into place. And, you know, I think once people get to understand that, they start to see that this is not just a oops kind of thing. It's not like, oh, you know, if only you'd done that, it would have been different. No, this had to happen, you know. And we look back in history and we look at what happened during the Depression, the Great Depression through the 1930s leading up to World War II. And what we see was, you know, you can sort of draw a line between, say, 1929 and then post that. You know, what we had a system that grew and grew and grew and then collapsed. Then we had the Great Depression. We had this huge slowdown where the money supply dried up. And then we had a massive world war, which killed hundreds of millions of people, which was just devastated, you know, the Western industrialized world in Europe. I mean, Europe really was the hub of the Western world then. Europe.
Yeah.
You know, and then out of the rubble of that, out of the ruins of that, we had this new phase of economic growth that began in the 50s and then continued and continued and continued now to reach again another peak, another bubble, which, you know, if you look at it historically, you have to think, well, we've reached another one of those points where it just can't, there's going to be something along the lines of what we've seen in the past. It's not going to be the same. I'm not saying it's going to be the same, and fingers crossed it's not going to be a Holocaust or, you know, I really hope that doesn't happen, but we've reached one of those points, right?
Absolutely. And it's really important for people to realize that historically what happens in economic downturns is people start putting uniforms on. And it's really, really important to reject that and to reject, you know, mutations of nationalism through the forms of violence and protectionism and all the rest of this sort of garbage, because that's the easy path. You know, the hard path is to actually take on what the real issues here are. And the real issues are the monopolization of currency. I mean, I'm not allowed to create a currency, you know, I mean, and that's ridiculous. I should be able to create a currency and compete with the currency in a free market way. And that would force other currencies to compete with me and with anyone else. So, I mean, that sounds stupid. I create a currency. But let's explain it a little bit easier. What if Virgin, as a bigger corporation and a bigger reach, decided to make frequent flyer points, right? And you could also use those points in Woolworths and, you know, other places, and eventually it becomes a currency. And then that puts pressure on, because if suddenly currencies become ridiculously inflated or deflated, people shift to other currencies that aren't, that are being a bit more normal. Concept. You know, but because we have this monopolization, global monopolization through the massive banking elite, we're stuck with what they choose. Now, right now, London is about to start printing 75 billion. That's 165 billion Australian dollars. And just put that into the market, right? That is basically stealing through inflation, which is another form of tax. And that's a very, very, very fundamental thing, which is never taught in school, never talked about on the news, that inflation is tax. It is stealing from your savings. When you put $10 in the bank and inflation comes along with 5% in 1 year.
It's ironic, isn't it? That at the same time as that we're talking about, you know, emissions trading scheme and you know, carbon tax, we've got all these other things occurring which are de facto taxes anyway.
Exactly, which I never taught. And you know, you mentioned about the media is to blame before, John. But I also think the educational system is to blame, because I was never taught about where money comes from. I was never taught about the historical concepts of money. All I was taught is how great Captain Cook was for invading, not even invading, for discovering Australia. You know, rubbish like this.
Can I take the debate? Like, I know the basis of money, obviously, money is all about goods. It's about giving, better give something to someone in lieu of goods and services that you will receive later or whatever. It's, you know, it's the reason we invented money was to make it more easy to, rather than loading up your wheelbarrow with shells or gold or whatever it was that you were trading in, or spices or whatever, you could use cash, you know, to trade. And obviously having something general that you could trade meant that you didn't have to have a particular thing. You could, you know, you could have whatever it was that you specialized in, and that allowed civilization to become more complex and grow and all the things that happen. Like, we need money, obviously. It's important. And fundamentals of money and how it all works, that's all great. But let's, I'd prefer to talk about the solution. Now what we see, the analogy I sort of thought up myself the other day when I was talking to this doctor by the pool, which is quite interesting conversation, was we were talking about the system is hemorrhaging and the blood's running out of the system. Now, the only argument I've heard that makes any sense to me is we have to write off what's gone, and we have to simply, you know, cut those derivatives and plug the hole, rather than what we're doing at the moment is transfusing the system with more blood to pump out the open wound. You know, there's no end in sight. So unless we say, right, what's gone's gone, and we have to write off those derivatives and those debts, and we have to re-regulate the system, and possibly, I know Lyndon LaRouche is favoured by some and not by others, but he talks about, you know, going back to, you know, standard set figures on what currencies are worth in between countries or whatever, like, to stabilise things, rather than, like you're saying, like this float of speculation just doesn't allow anything to stabilise. It just continues to bleed. It's like it's not allowing the scab to set on the wound. Does that make sense?
That's so true.
Well, you're right. And you're right because at the moment there is no free market. It's a pseudo-free market. It's actually a monopoly. And that monopoly system on money is you know, there's really basically what they're doing right now is throwing cane toads into the mix to try and get rid of the little bugs that eat things, not realizing that the cane toads are a massive problem in themselves.
Debt, yeah, you're talking about debt, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I see when I look at it? I see a power grab. I just see this is a power grab. That it's one way of doing it is to inflate the bubble, keep inflating it and burst it, and of course the banks then own everything, and that seems to be from another way of looking at it, the whole agenda, and that's where you start to see other things in perspective of, and you see the connections between things, because what we've seen since the turn of the 21st century is this consolidation of power, this transfer, as Dennis Kucinich put it, the transfer of power upwards.
You might confuse people by saying banks, but here, you know, we're really talking about the, you know, the 200-300 wealthiest families in the world. The banks that are going tits up.
Oh yeah,
moment,
I'm not,
you know,
talking
think,
about your average.
Going, what do you mean the banks are doing so well? Because I've had this discussion. I'm saying the bankers, and they're saying the bankers are all broke. They're all going bust. But I tell you, the people that funded those banks originally, or the people that pulled their money out of them years ago or a year ago, they're not doing it tough at all. The shell that they've left behind is, you
know, a few banks will go bust. A few high flyers, high profile people will go down. But they're just, you know, they're the ones that were disposable anyway. You know, and you know, the central banks.
We're talking about the central banks, not your bank. Not your national bank on the main, you know, down on George Street. You know, yeah, these might have big buildings and might, you go in there and high ceilings and all the rest of it. And,
This is the other thing, Josh, that really find nauseating is when you have all these news stories about, you know, some some banker, some corporate guy who's being paid too much, as if that's the bloody problem. You
it
know?
Does my head in.
It's they, just they talk that about, that is such a distraction.
This CEO is getting paid, you know, $46 million. Who gives a sh? Like, who exactly. really cares? Honestly, good on him. That's nothing. It's nothing.
It's designed to focus your hatred and anger on an expendable figure that can then be sacrificed, and then we can say, like the French, look, we put that person in prison. Oh, aren't we good? You know, it's absurd.
Exactly what. It's what happened at the French Revolution, you know, everyone going after the bourgeois and thinking that someone with $1 million is mega rich.
Yeah.
They're not.
Not at all. You really have to be in the multi-billion dollar class. And even then, you know, some of these people who are the poster boys for success, like, you know, Murdoch and, say, Bill Gates and Richard Branson, I mean, they're not anywhere near, to my mind.
They're not in the top 200 families. They're not.
To my mind, they're nowhere near the controlling level.
No.
I mean, they're kind of like ordinary people who were lucky and made good, and they're useful, I think, you know, because everyone wants to think, oh, I could be Richard Branson, don't they? Like, everyone wants to think that. I could be Bill Gates, you know? But, you know, you can't be, okay? There's only a few slots available, okay, and they're taken. and there won't be any more, you know. And if there are, you know, there'll be a lot of contenders for those slots, you know. So you can't, the idea that you can just somehow make it through business and make it to that level, I think is been proven time and again that it's not the way it works.
You know. But yeah, I think if anyone else has anything to add to this conversation, please drop us a comment on the website. It's very important.
Yeah, please do.
To have your input.
We look forward to the comments.
So what do you guys think then? Like, we've got to present some sort of idea of where we're going to go with this. Now, obviously, the playing field needs to be fair. Now, we can't really address these very, very wealthy people that have influence on government. What we have to do is make government transparent. We have to expose things like 9/11 to allow that to happen, to allow this transformation of government back to something that really represents us. Then we have to diminish the ability for these people to use their money. Obviously, we can't just take their money off them because they've got it. I mean, possibly that might happen if there's some sort of revolution, I suppose. But really what we need to do is remove their controlling influence. Now, the only way we can do that is by letting governments that represent the people produce their own money. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and allowing the you know, getting rid of Federal Reserve systems and allowing the demonopolization of currency. It's very important.
Governments need to provide currency for their people so they can trade goods and services, and there needs to be enough currency so that can happen freely. Now, that's the purpose of money, but at the moment, money has become something that's just numbers and on a spreadsheet.
Well, it's debt.
That is manipulated by speculators and the super rich. So we need to get that back to normal. But first of all, we need to regulate the system somehow to stop this hemorrhage, don't we? How do we do that? Does anyone have the knowledge of what's Kucinich saying, or what's obviously he's saying get rid of the Federal Reserve. Let's see the American government print the money it needs to stabilize its economy and fix its currency rates. I suppose that's something else he's saying, which will allow the American system to stabilize. Is that what all the world
Kucinich
should be doing?
Kucinich is a Democrat, and he adheres to some of the sort of social democratic ideals, and he kind of does believe the government has an important role in coming to the rescue. You know, on the other hand, you've got the radical free market propositions of Ron Paul. The interesting thing is that Kucinich and Ron Paul have a lot in common, even though they're quite divergent. But they both recognize the injustice of this rape of the average person. They can both see that that's going on. You know, I don't know. I don't even try to be... I don't know what the solutions are. I'm not really a solutions person. I mean, I'm someone who wants to expose injustice and will, you know, I want to penetrate. I want to focus on these issues. And, you know, I can say, well, here are these people that have said this. Paul Grignon, who made money as debt, basically said, yes, governments must issue their own currency. That was his solution.
Yeah.
Josh, you've been following...
I agree with that. Does Josh agree with that too?
Well, Josh, you've been following the ideas of, was that Philip Molyneux? Is that the correct name? Hello?
His name is Stefan.
Stefan Molyneux, who's got a really interesting blog, who's got some, you know, quite interesting ideas.
Free domain radio. He's an anarcho-capitalist, believes in no government at all. And
radical free market. It's sort of like, I mean, that's where you get the idea of, like, everyone can create their own currency. I mean, currency is not handed down from above, as it were. Currency could be, you could issue your own sort of equivalent of frequent flyer points sort of thing.
Well, if people use it, if it's worth enough that people will want to use it, then it should be legitimate. I mean, if I go around and people actually take my little clamshells and start using them as worth, why shouldn't that happen? I mean, why should that be illegal?
The complexity of the world today, say, for instance, what I do for a living, like I can service your aircraft and fix its faults and then say it's okay to fly within what we've specified as the safety regulations within Australia. Now, but how can I offer that service to someone that doesn't own a plane? Or how can I, you know, like, say, the reason we've got a currency, I see, like a currency within a civilization as such, is so that, you know, the flux or the movement of goods and services, depending on what speciality people do, allows that to happen. Now, so,
I know, but John, we're not living back in, you know, 1920s.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
We've got electronics and numbers. We don't even need banks anymore. I mean, we can have a card with a bunch of numbers on it.
Well, I would say.
I know what you're saying. I sort of know what you're saying. What you're really not saying is we need to create our own money, but we need to be able to demonstrate our own worth in a fair way.
Well, I would say that this is already happening.
That's right. If someone's willing to take my money, is just like anything. It's like sofas. It's like TVs and guitars. It's just something. The only thing that makes a difference is you use that to buy other things, which you don't use guitars and stuff for. So money is the same. If you have more of the things, then it becomes worth less and more and this and that to a consumer that wants to buy it. And that's so. For instance, when they start making money really cheap, what that is saying is that they're printing more and giving more out. So it's just another commodity. And if my money, if I start to create money and people actually think, well, his money's staying, keeping its worth. So if I stick Josh dollars in my account, they're not going anywhere. But if they are, I'm going to start selling them and getting something else that's, you know.
Guys, we need to wind up in the next 5 minutes. Continue. But if there's any last really important points you want to make, please go ahead.
All I'm saying is monopolies don't work.
Yeah.
Well, let's get a little bit of consensus just on a few points that I think we all agree on, which is governments should be looking after their own money, not private bankers.
Yeah.
Also, we need to stop the hemorrhage rather than pumping money or more debt into the system. And the way to do that is to come up with some sort of method of regulating this and maybe removing some of the speculation from the system that destabilizes it so much, like you said, Josh. Would you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't say removing it by force, though. I'd just say putting less force, less regulation, because I think less forcing people to put their money in super, I think, is an absolute atrocity. If people choose to, that's fine.
Who created the market, with this put options and, like, gambling on people's livelihood? Like, that's what we're doing in the stock exchange. Isn't that what you said has sort of led? Like, people have been actively gambling, playing the shell game and all sorts of corruption. How is that allowed to happen, like, in the stock market? Like, how do we regulate that or stop that? Stop people gambling, with people's retirement. How do we stop that?
Well, by not forcing people to put their retirement into the hands of these people.
There you go. Right. So yeah. Okay. I see. You're coming from the sort of the right wing capitalist sort of point of view, where we have to not force anything, and people will figure it out from themselves.
Yeah.
I'd be coming from the more we need to regulate, not allow that to happen. You know, so which is more the Finnish Democrat side. You know. But there's some things that they agree on. They agree on the government's got to look after the money, not the banks. You know, you don't put the bloody the hens in the hands of the fox. And we need transparency, and we need to talk about the issues truthfully and with people that actually know what they're talking about on the TV. That would help, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't mind the government. If the government need to, that's a much better idea than the central bankers. But all I'm saying is, on top of government allowing the to have the influence of money, that corporations or private, whoever, it shouldn't be a monopoly. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I think we also just need to really bear in mind the historical parallels, the cycles of history, and see that this is part of a social struggle. It's, I mean, I don't like to use that word class struggle because it sounds, you know, Marxist or something, but, you know, that's what it is. It's just that the elite class is so tiny, you know, they're a really tiny class. And we are, everyone else is kind of excluded, and it's this elitist system that I see that has to go. So that's the way I look at it. I try to see it in those terms, is that this elitist structure has to be torn down. We've got to do it. We've got to try and minimize the violence, try and minimize, you know, the bloodshed that usually goes along with attempts to do that, you know, which have always seemed to fail. Okay, but we really do have to move away from that model. So anyway, that's my two cents.
Well, look, I think, you know, for instance, my two cents on that is, I think you're absolutely correct, and I think the best way to do that non-violently is to shop locally.
Yeah, we've got to reconnect. We've got to use what we've got. We've got to build our own networks. We've got to build our own local networks, you know. And then
food co-ops.
Yeah. So many different ideas there.
Well, Carol Buey, who's been a long-term 9/11 activist, uses that term community currency. And you wouldn't know it, but she's actually an expert on economics. And that's her other passion besides 9/11. And, she would be an interesting person to talk about.
We'd love to get her on the show. Look, we've got a lot of really interesting shows lined up for this year. This has been our first show of the year. It's kind of a warm-up. We're going to, each week, we're going to be back next week. I wanted to get into more stuff tonight, but we talked about the financial situation. I think it was
a big topic.
It's been excellent.
Yeah, and we're not experts on it, are we? We're just having a bit of chat about it, you know?
Indeed.
Exactly. I mean, I'm no economic, economist, so take this for what you paid for it, really.
Yeah.
Just a whole lot of thoughts spinning around, but I think we've got a better handle on it than most of the people that are telling us on the television.
We do. And on that note, we're going to wind it up for tonight.
Thank you, Harold.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, John. It's been fantastic. Thanks, all the listeners out there. Hope that there are more than, you know, hope that there are more every week. Stay in touch. Stay in touch with the site. Visit www.truthnews.com.au, and we will be seeing you, and you'll be hearing from us very soon. Good night.